This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, November 19th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
Nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
The history of nonviolent protest in America stretches back to Native American communities before the nation was founded. In the 19th century, abolitionists and suffragists faced down mobs as they argued for freedom and equal rights. In the 20th century, civil rights protesters organized bus boycotts, marches, and mass demonstrations in the name of social justice. In the weeks since Election Day, as President Trump has refused to concede to President-elect Biden and stoked conspiracy theories about a fraudulent election, his enablers in the Republican Party have rallied behind him. Trump replaced his Secretary of Defense and other Pentagon officials with loyalists. He refuses to cooperate with Biden's transition team. His Attorney General, William Barr, authorized federal prosecutors to investigate Trump's specious claims of voter fraud. And last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told reporters with a smirk during a press briefing that there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. Are Trump's actions the flailing response of a sore loser or an attempt at an authoritarian power grab? Activists and academics argue that in either case, it's time for ordinary citizens to stop the slide to autocracy by, as one expert puts it, pulling the fire alarm on our democracy. Andrew Morantz, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss what has been learned in recent years about successful civil resistance movements and how to take action to restore a stable democracy. Andrew, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, as I mentioned above, academics, activists, and journalists, actually, have been warning about creeping authoritarianism ever since Trump took office. You've done a lot of your own reporting on the trend, and most recently you talked to many activists and scholars of civil resistance. One of them, Erica Chenoweth, a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School, told you that there's no one moment when a country crosses from a democracy into an autocracy. Could you talk a little about how Chenoweth describes what's been occurring in the U.S.?
Yeah, so, you know, we have, as we often do, a fair amount of American exceptionalism built into our kind of mythos as a country, where we think, you know, things like power grabs and coups and abuses of power that are brazen and flagrant, those are all things that happen in other countries. They don't happen here. And there's never really ever been a logical reason to believe that. We have a history of civil war in this country. There are many scholars who argue that the United States has always been part authoritarian, depending on which region and what race you are, or what gender you are, and you can go on down the list, right? So, but of course, in the Trump era, these things are much more on the surface, and he is, as many people say, saying the quiet part loud, right? So he's just saying outright that he won't accept the results of an election if he doesn't like what the results are. And so what scholars like Chenoweth point out is that because American exceptionalism has never really had any reason to apply to us, we do have to take these threats seriously. So even though it looks like Trump's very ham-fisted attempt at a power grab is not working, it doesn't mean that the structures that are in place to stop it are infallible, right? So we need to, as you put it, pull the fire alarm, not necessarily because there is a three-alarm fire raging at the moment, but because we have seen so plainly in this moment that we're vulnerable to it.
What has Chenoweth discovered about successful nonviolent movements around the world?
So one thing that's actually kind of empowering in this scary and disempowering moment, right, is that when you look at all these things that would-be authoritarians try to do, like Trump and many others around the world, it can seem like once they take the institutions under their control, that there's no way to fight back against it, right? It's, you sort of start to feel incredibly powerless, and you start to feel, well, if he can just you know, contravene the results of an election, and if he can just take over the courts and take over the state legislatures, you know, what can be done? And what scholars, including Chenoweth, have found is that what they call civil resistance or unarmed insurrection or strategic nonviolent conflict, there are many, many terms for it, but basically people can rise up and democratically take control back from governments that have gone off the rails. And this doesn't involve entrenched guerrilla forces. In fact, what Chenoweth, in groundbreaking work in 2011, along with the political scientist Maria Stephan, what they found in this 2011 book called Why Civil Resistance Works is that unarmed resistance movements are about twice as effective as armed resistance movements, right? So the cartoon we have in our head is that if you have a dictatorship or you have a military junta or something and you want to dislodge it, you have to take up arms and it's going to be really dangerous. It's going to be a long, protracted, bloody struggle. And of course, there are situations when that has happened. But on the whole, and when you run the numbers, you find that the unarmed movements tend to be bigger, they tend to be perceived as more legitimate, and they tend to win more often. So that this feeling of powerlessness, that there's nothing you, the people, can do, that actually just turns out to be wrong.
So give us a couple of examples that Chenoweth cites as successful nonviolent resistance movements.
So there are a few in the book. They go pretty in-depth into the Iranian Revolution of 1979. Of course, the aftermath of that revolution didn't work out so great. But, you know, the way that you dislodge a character like the Shah of Iran, or the way you dislodge Slobodan Milosevic, let's say, in 2000 in Serbia, I mean, this was one of the most entrenched and terrifying and brutal dictators in the world. And yet, if you use the right combination of tactics, right? So a lot of what this work goes into is how exactly you orchestrate a nonviolent revolution. It's not just marching in the streets. That's merely one part of it. And in fact, it's a very overplayed part of it. A lot of it has to do with economic non-cooperation, you know, boycotts and strikes. And a lot of it has to do with sort of acts of street theater or civil disobedience. Some of it has to do with finding secret levers of power that most people don't take the time to research, like which bureaucrats you can get to defect to your side. No matter how totalitarian the system is, no matter how brutal it is, it doesn't exist without the support of institutions and people. And what this theory of power essentially posits is that if people start rescinding their support, the whole tower falls. So it can look, I mean, the way that dictators want to appear is all powerful, and they want to seem, you know, that all power flows from the barrel of a gun and they have more tanks than you, so there's nothing you can do. But in fact, if the bureaucrats stop showing up to work, if the coal miners don't show up to power the power plants, if the tax collectors stop filling the coffers of the government, these things can fall within a matter of weeks.
You know, I've been reading the most recent news about defections among CEOs and former national security officials talking out against what Trump is doing right now. We even see a few tentative ones from Republicans on Capitol Hill. Could you talk a little bit about that and what other examples you've been noticing?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. I was reporting this piece kind of immediately before and after the election because, you know, remember, we didn't know how this was going to go, right? If it had been closer, we really could have been in a much more tenuous situation, right? So as I was reporting it and talking to folks like Chenoweth before and after the election, you know, I would email and say, oh, it looks like the vote tallies are coming in and you know, there might be a safe margin by which Trump will be defeated. And Chenoweth's response would never be, oh, yes, the vote tally looks safe. It would always be more about things like you're saying, pillars of support, power centers. It was always a conversation that was more about momentum than it was about simple math. So when you see little blips and irregularities, when you see someone like you pointed out, Mike Pompeo, refusing to even, you know, acknowledge the fact that his boss lost the election, what people like Chenoweth look to is to see if there are other pillars of society that are answering back in the other direction. So it could be business leaders, it could be clergy, it could be teachers. There are ways to move the momentum that are kind of off the map, right? That are extra institutional, that actually end up often being more influential than just the way the rules are written.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So what is new about the work of these academics? I was interested in your piece. You talk about the political scientist Gene Sharp, who back in 1973 published a big three-volume book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, which drew on centuries of examples. And one of my favorites was how Iroquois women in the 16th century won political rights through coordinated actions, including refraining from sex and refusing to harvest crops and make moccasins for soldiers. So what does Chenoweth and what do other scholars have to add to what Sharp and others who had been active in some of these resistance already had shown the world?
Chenoweth and Stefan and people like that have added to that literature in part just by documenting how these tactics have proliferated and evolved, right? So tactics are constantly evolving, and the bigger and more widespread the movement is, the more it can draw on different people's creativity, right? So you see things morphing in the age of COVID. You see things morphing in the age of internet and cell phone technology. People are using drones to do civil disobedience. One example that ended up in the piece that was cataloged by Stephen Zunis, another scholar of this stuff, was in Western Sahara. It's illegal to fly the flag there. So there were activists who they announced that they were going to do this civil disobedience, but instead of flying the flags themselves, they tied the flags to the tails of these feral cats and then had to make the soldiers choose whether you're going to go try to arrest a bunch of cats or whether you're going to let the law be violated. So these part of it is just sort of anthropologically documenting how creative activists continue to evolve their tactics. Part of it is doing the kind of quantitative political science work. There have been about twice as many nonviolent revolutions in the world just in the past 19 years as there were in the preceding 100 years, right? This thing has really continued to explode and proliferate. And although nonviolent uprisings continue to outperform violent ones, the success rate on the whole has gone down because for a variety of reasons, the internet makes it easier to get people out to the streets, but it makes it harder to sustain the kind of deep tissue of organizing. Organizing is just a massive area of study that continues to evolve and that will continue to need to be studied in more detail.
In the past few years, Black Lives Matter, this is probably the most obvious example in the United States of successful organizing. Tell us what has been accomplished by these marches.
Yeah, Chenoweth was pretty insistent on pointing out that the only reason we have a vibrant pro-democracy movement leading up to the 2020 election is that it's drawing on the momentum of the movement for Black Lives and the movement for immigrants' rights and the sanctuary movement and the climate movement. These are all interconnected. And you saw, even in this election, a lot of the energy coming out of the uprisings from the summer, a lot of that energy got translated into voter turnout and voter registration in places like Georgia and also in places like Texas, where the Democrats fell short, but maybe less short than they could have been expected to. So sometimes we fold a lot of this stuff in under just the umbrella of, oh, well, that's just Democratic politics, Democratic with a small D. Sometimes you win more votes, sometimes you win fewer votes, and we kind of just take it as baked in. But what that sometimes obscures when you don't look at it closely enough is the extent to which there was nothing foreordained about the idea that Joe Biden would win Georgia or Arizona or any of these other states. That was the product of a lot of factors, some of which were having to do with the national media and the messaging, but some of which had to do with people organizing their communities to make sure that people were registered and people turned out. So we often look at these things as separate. You know, people are either in the streets or they are, you know, voting in an election. But in fact, they're intimately intertwined.
The other problem is how to combat, you talked about social media, the power of social media, and how do you combat the noxious, you know, spread of disinformation by the administration and other outlets, which really distorts the political debate and is believed by, as we saw in this election, by a very large number of voters?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've seen some baby steps from the companies to handle this, but I don't think that this is going away anytime soon as a really fundamental problem. I mean, we just saw Barack Obama calling this an existential crisis, which I think is a conclusion that many of us have also come to independently, that we are in an informational crisis that is kind of similar to the climate crisis or any one of these other massive crises that we're facing, where we really need to think about how we might rebuild our informational infrastructure from the ground up. And you know, that kind of gets us back to the organizing point, right? It would be great to have a top-down solution to all this stuff. It would be great to have a functioning institutional infrastructure where people put out reliable, true information and everyone believed it. That's not the world we live in. And so you can approach it with top-down solutions like government regulation and, you know, tweaking incentives and all the rest of it. But you also have to have a bottom-up solution, and that's where that organizational infrastructure comes in again. You know, if you cede all the ground to your Sinclair news network or your Facebook group or whatever unreliable source of information, and you don't have a local network of community groups or organizations where neighbors are giving each other more reliable information, then you're just sort of conceding that territory, and it's hard to see how you gain ground.
Yeah, Chenoweth talks about the need for alternative social institutions, saying, if I had to pick one characteristic that correlates with the movement's success, it's the extent to which everyone in society, children, disabled people, grandmas, feel that they can either actively or passively participate. What does Chenoweth have in mind exactly, given where we are right now?
Yeah, so part of this is a kind of empirical explanation for one reason why nonviolent movements tend to work better than violent movements in overthrowing even the most brutal regimes. If you have a mass movement that people feel that they can show up for without the danger of being shot or something, then you're just going to get more participation. So some of that might be in a place like Tahrir Square in Egypt, where people just feel that they can come out and it's a kind of vibrant atmosphere. It's multi-generational. They can, you know, there are concerts, there's a kind of party vibe, as opposed to, you know, being some kind of encampment in the mountains where, you know, only armed people with berets are allowed. That's one element. The other element, in that quote, Chenoweth says actively or passively support. A lot of movements are won or lost by passive support, right? So, you know, you have the people on the front lines who are showing up in the streets whenever there's a demonstration, and then you have passive support could be as simple as, you know, Amazon putting up a placard that says Black Lives Matter on their homepage. That's passive support almost to the point of laughable irrelevance, right? And it's something that people often mock, I think totally understandably, right? It doesn't mean that Amazon is now, you know, part of the resistance. But what it does mean is that the message is starting to diffuse across various sectors of society. And when you're in a situation where you have to uproot an entire regime, a lot of what you need is just for the message to be palatable enough that people won't actively work against it. The passive support then diffuses into the actions of individual actors within the system. So, you know, there's the example that's often given from Serbia that there was a policeman who was ordered to fire into a crowd of protesters and later told journalists, well, I didn't fire because I didn't know if I would be firing on my own children, right? That's an act of disobedience that is in a way passive, right? Because it's an act of omission rather than commission. But it has to do with how widespread the movement is, how legitimate it is perceived to be, and how far you can encroach into the center of power with people who are, you know, that guy was still a soldier for the regime. He hadn't quit his job or, you know, resigned and, you know, gone to jail or anything, but he was willing to resist just enough to make a decisive choice.
I'm sure you've heard, you know, endlessly over the past 4 years, as I have, people saying, you know, in desperation, sort of, what can I do? What can I do? And the work of Chenoweth and others sort of tells us what can be done. And I think if people learned nothing else from this election, they learned just the pure power of the vote and the importance of everyone getting out to vote. And you spoke to one activist when you were working on this piece who told you that many people now rightly think that if things go off the rails during or after the election, our institutions alone might not necessarily save us. And she went on, you know, once you realize that, you can go pretty quickly from despair to exhilaration. The institutions can't save us, but maybe we can save ourselves.
That is the one thing that I would have people take away from this moment, right? I think there's such a temptation, especially after just 4 years of exhaustion and confusion and terror, to go back to this feeling of comfort and complacency and say, well, look, in the end, the institutions did save us. And, you know, the courts threw out all the junk lawsuits that were filed by Rudy Giuliani because the courts work. And, you know, the Electoral College certified the results of the election, you know, knock on wood that they'll do that. So that therefore the institutions have saved us. And of course there's truth to that, right? There wasn't a massive authoritarian breakthrough in the way that some people were fearing, again, because the election just wasn't close enough. But I don't think that the proper takeaway from that is to just sort of go back to the way things were and show up every 2 years or every 4 years and cast your vote and think that you've done enough, right? I think one thing that we can learn from the history and present practice of civil resistance is that if you can use these tactics to do extreme things like stop a power grab after an election in Gambia or Serbia or Thailand, you can also use these tactics to achieve goals that are in some ways maybe less out of reach, like getting Mitch McConnell to allow Joe Biden to pass some legislation, or getting America to get its act together and have a plan for climate change, right? So I hope that that feeling of powerlessness and fear that so many people had over these last couple of weeks, not knowing if Donald Trump would actually leave the White House, that that can get channeled away from this one acute moment of fear and into the only slightly less acute series of moments that we're about to face, where we still have to get stuff done. And these tactics are just as useful for that moment as they would have been for this one.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Andrew Morantz is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden. We're off next week for Thanksgiving. Stay safe and enjoy the holiday.